is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I was a bit naive. It was the second time in my career I've been a victim of being naive. I figured I could just get another job. You know, I was on the front bench with the Celtics. Teams will be lining up to hire me. I'm not going to panic too much. I did want to be a head coach at the time. I was kind of starting to become obsessed with that, and not in a good way.
Scott Morrison is an assistant coach for the NBA's Utah Jazz. He was previously the head coach of the Salt Lake City Stars of the NBA G League during the 2022-23 season. Morrison spent the 21-22 season as the head coach of the Perth Wildcats of Australia's National Basketball League. He had served the four previous seasons as a Boston Celtics assistant under Brad Stevens. Morrison earned his opportunity with the Celtics after coaching with the Maine Red Claws in the NBA D League from 2013 to 2017. In 2001, after his first year of graduate studies at Dalhousie University, Morrison was appointed an assistant coach of Dalhousie's women's basketball team. In 2002, as a 24-year-old, he was elevated to the head coach of the team. In 2003, Morrison was appointed head coach of Lakehead University's men's basketball team. Under his leadership, Lakehead went from the worst team in the nation in 2006 to a perennial top-five program in Canada from 2008 to 2013. For the 2013-14 season, Morrison took a one-year sabbatical, leading to his opportunity with the Maine Red Claws. Morrison was born and raised in Morrell, Prince Edward Island, and attended Morrell Regional High School. Growing up, his father, George, was the head coach of the UPEI Panthers men's basketball program. From 1995 to 2000, Morrison attended the University of Prince Edward Island and played for the Panthers, graduating as the school's all-time leader in assists and three-point field goals made, and ranking fifth on the all-time scoring list. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Scott Morrison, assistant coach for the NBA's Utah Jazz. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hey, this is Monty Patel, head boys coach of East End Public Charter School in Little Rock, Arkansas, and you are listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Scott Morrison, assistant coach for the NBA's Utah Jazz. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Scott Morrison, assistant coach for the NBA's Utah Jazz. Scott, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Yeah, thanks, man. Happy to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do throughout your coaching career. You've had a wide range of different places that you've been and different levels, so excited to talk to you about all those. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball. I know your dad was a college coach in Canada, so just talk a little about some of those first experiences you had.
Sure. So I grew up in a place that's probably the least likely, just getting down there, maybe in the world, I was going to say North America, to produce a pro basketball coach. Grew up in a little village called Morrell in Prince Edward Island, which is basically the smallest place in the smallest province in Canada. I remember working, I used to work for the village in the summers during college, doing maintenance on the sports fields. And mowing lawns and things like that. And my buddy and I were wondering what the population was one day. So we decided just to go around and count it. And we came up with just under 300. So, but I had one kind of, I guess, card up my sleeve when it comes to basketball. As you mentioned, my dad was a college coach. So he would drive the 30 minutes into the quote unquote city of Charlottetown and run his college program, University of Prince Edward Island, from there. So basically, as early as I can remember, I was going to practices and going on the team van, which later became the team bus, and kind of had a dream to eventually play for my dad. I played all through high school and things like that, obviously, and was kind of doubled as the team manager or video guy or water boy, depending on how old I was at the time, and eventually kind of made full circle and played for my dad when I graduated high school for 5 years. We were allowed 5 years of eligibility in Canada, even before COVID. So I used them all up and then moved on.
How'd you get better as a player growing up in such a small town? Were you always playing with guys that your dad was coaching, or just how'd that work for you?
So earlier on, I was lucky to have, just by a lottery, it probably never happened again, you know, in the 30 years since then. But I had four or five friends that were the exact same age that growing up there. And we all love sports. We played baseball together all through school, basketball. And my dad was at least by pay, was a part-time college coach. He also was a high school teacher. So we could all walk to the high school, and I had the keys to the gym. So, you know, once we hit junior high or a little bit earlier, we would go in there 3-4 times a week, play 2-on-2 or 3-on-3, depending on how many guys we could get. And then as I got older, that became kind of my sanctuary to go in there and shoot and work on my individual skills either with my dad or by myself. And then my last couple of years of high school, I started to get good enough to play, you know, in the preseason and the off season with my dad's team. So they had pretty good teams. It's probably equivalent to a high D2 level. So it's pretty easy to get better when you're playing against bigger and stronger guys all the time like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Did you always know you wanted to coach because of your dad?
Well, earlier on, I thought I just would play in the NBA, and then, realized I had a few things working against me there, namely my athleticism, size, and skill level. So turned to wanting to be a college coach in Canada, and kind of had set a goal to there's some coaching education things you can do here. There's a master's program in Canada. There's a qualifications course that we do. So I started doing that pretty early on during college. And also every summer I would spend some time working camps in the U.S., like schools like UConn and Maryland and Holy Cross, wherever I could get into, trying to, A, make some contacts for coaching down the road, but also at the time get a chance to play pickup against some pretty good players when camp was over, sort of thing. So had some thoughts of it, but wasn't sure where the path was going to take me until I graduated.
What was your favorite camp you worked?
That's a tough one, actually, to be honest. I went back to UConn 2 or 3 years. It was right when they won with Khalid El-Amin and those guys. I was also around Maryland when they won with Steve Blake and that crew. So I had a great time at both those camps. Met some people that I still am friends with. Coach Patsos took good care of us at Maryland. And fast forward a few years when he was coaching Loyola, I brought my college team from Canada down to play him. So that kind of became full circle as well in a certain way. And we've stayed in touch over the years. So I'd say UConn or Maryland are my favorites, but I probably did maybe 10 or 15 different schools in that period.
Yeah. Building up that contact list is huge, especially when you're a young guy, to be able to have those contacts that you can fall back on as you move forward and keep going in your career. Your first experience was on the women's side though, right?
Yeah. So one of those courses that I was referring to that I took in the summer one time when I was playing college was a level, whatever. We have like 3 or 4 levels of coaching. And once you hit the top level, you can kind of instruct the lower levels. So I took a course from a legendary women's coach named Carolyn Savoy. She was kind of a disciple of Pat Summitt to a certain degree. They were friends. And she taught the course. And then fast forward 3 or 4 years, I was doing my master's at Dalhousie where she taught, which is in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I said to myself, it's time to get back into coaching. I did 1 year away from organized ball and just went to school and played men's league. And then I said, okay, I missed it. So I was actually on the way to meet with the men's coach at that school about being one of his assistants the following year. He had about 4 or 5 assistants already, all volunteer. And I stopped for a workout on the way to meet him and ran into Coach Savoy, the women's coach. And she asked me what I was doing next year. I told her what I was looking to do, and she offered me an assistant spot on her staff. And she only had one other assistant, so I took it because I was familiar with her, and she had kind of come to me. So I thought well of that, and then thinking that I would probably get to do a lot more because of the situation with her staff was pretty slim. So I went for it.
Coaching women, was that any different? Was there any surprises, anything that you thought, oh, I didn't expect it to go that way? Or just what was that like for you going on the women's side?
Well, I actually really enjoyed it because being a young coach, I was the same age as some of the girls on the team. And I had played in the same conference as most of them, you know, as a player before I shifted over. But at least that team, and I think in general, I think girls are a little bit more willing to be coached at the college level. At least they were back then. Didn't think they knew it all. You know, were happy to get someone that would go into the gym with them and work out, whereas sometimes the guys maybe took it for granted. And this is obviously like 2002. It's a little bit of time ago, but that's how it was back then. So I earned their trust that way, and they made it easier for me by being, you know, good teammates and good players that wanted to learn. I was learning a lot from Coach, and she, near the end of that season, she decided to take a sabbatical, which is not normal in NCAA, but in Canada, it's fairly normal to take a year off with pay and go do some professional development because the salaries aren't that high, and that's an incentive you can get in your contract. So she told me she wanted me to be the interim head coach the following year. So it was my first year out of grad school, and took over the team. I remember the first thing I said to the girls was, I'm not a girls coach, but I'm a basketball coach, and that's how we're going to handle things. And I think that also kind of earned their respect a little bit because they didn't want to be treated different than the guys either. So that's how I handled it.
What were you good at right away from a coaching standpoint? Was there something that one particular aspect that you feel like, man, I really had this right from the get-go, and then maybe there were some other things that obviously you had to learn along the way?
Well, I was good at yelling at people, referees and players alike, which turned out wasn't the best course of action as time progressed, but that was what I was good at the start. I think I always was a hard worker, and I learned from my dad that recruiting was about relationships from an early age. My bedroom was above his office. His office was in the basement, but I could hear all his recruiting calls over the years, like sitting in bed, listening to him talk to these kids. And I don't think he was any kind of John Wooden in terms of X's and O's. He was very self-taught and worked hard, but he was a great recruiter and was able to get kind of recruit above his level. And I think that's how I kind of got a little, carved a little niche, depending on what country you're in, to be valuable to Coach Savoy, because I would really grind it out and handwrite all my letters and drive to see the girls play that I could see in local area, and knew that I had to kind of earn their trust before they'd be willing to believe me that we would take care of them and make them better players and all the other things.
So that experience there, Coach Savoy comes back, and then you get an opportunity at Lakehead on the men's side. How does that come to be?
Yeah, so I just got lucky. I just kept getting lucky, to be honest. The year I was an interim coach with the girls, the men's team actually hired a new coach, a guy named John Campbell, who comes from pretty strong lineage in Canadian university circles. John and I became good friends, and job opened up at Lakehead University, where his old AD at his previous job was best friends with the AD at Lakehead. And I'd actually applied for the Lakehead women's job in like February and didn't even get a call back. The men's job opened up in late spring, and John, my friend, said, why don't you apply for that? I said, well, I applied for the women's job and never even got a call. I'm probably going to get this one. He said, well, this time put my name down as a reference and I'll make a call for you, because I didn't know you had applied for the women. So I did, and sure enough, I got a call for an interview. Four of us interviewed, I believe, and the other three all turned down the job before they offered it to me. But I didn't care. I took it. It was pretty low paying, and Lakehead is in a town called Thunder Bay in Northern Ontario, which is known for curling and having a lot of NHL players. It's basically an ice box all winter. And they had some success historically, but not recently when I was there. And basically within 2 years, we were the worst program in the country and one of the worst locations to recruit. But it turned out to be a pretty good place to learn and figure things out.
What was the key to turning it around there? When you went in there and looked at what you had to work with and, again, the history of the program, where you wanted to take it, what were one or two of the things that you felt like, hey, this is what we have to get done, and then eventually got done to be able to have the success that you did?
Well, I think the recruiting piece was massive because there was no local really talent to speak of. The nearest city to us would have been Winnipeg or Minneapolis, both about 6-7 hour drives, and really just lakes and forest in between those points. So I had to recruit, had to call on some of those contacts that I had met working camps and so forth. We were allowed to have 3 international players each season, which I did every year I was there. And then I started trying to take some big swings with talent outweighing character. Had some brief early success and then fell flat. And I had a lot of problems off the court with guys and realized that I was going about it the wrong way. I had to build a better foundation with character and potential, maybe pass on some of the shinier people that I could be looking at. And what happened was we went to the complete bottom of the country. We were 1-31 the year I decided to rebuild and clean house. Had 12 freshmen out of 15 on the roster. Probably very close to losing my job, but they wouldn't have wanted to pay me the extra year. And just decided to really, we tried to create some jobs to keep guys in town for the summer. And got better, started to add a little bit better quality of player. And then by those guys' fifth year, the 1-31 team, we won our first conference championship in 30 years. So I guess what I learned was that you do need some talent, but the foundation and the character and the quality of the person is far outweighing the talent at the end of the day, especially at the college level.
So what did that recruiting process look like for you since you're so far away from the talent bases that you have to recruit from? And obviously, I'm sure you don't have a giant budget to be flying all over the place. So what are you doing recruiting wise? How are you getting guys even to consider you? And then how are you putting together your list of talent? Is that just through the contacts that you had that you're reaching out to people, or how did you go about building that base of recruiting?
Well, that was the start. Trying to just tap at any contacts I had. Obviously, I had to go travel a little bit as much as I could and try to build my network of high school coaches, and we didn't have much AAU at the time, at least in Canada, but club coaches, and try to identify kids like in grade 9 and 10, because where we were located, it was really hard to convince kids from the city, from Toronto, from Montreal, from Baltimore and DC, where I recruited a lot, to come to our area. And it was like a 3-year process just to convince them that this was a viable opportunity for them. And hopefully by the time they have to actually decide in that third year that we're putting a decent product on the court and they can see that our guys have improved. The other thing we leaned on was kind of second chance guys, not necessarily because of character, but because of maybe bad luck, injuries, things like that. In Canada, there's no clock with eligibility. So you have 5 years to play. You could literally play when you're 50, as long as you hadn't played pro or anything like that before. So we would look for, D1 level guys who maybe couldn't get into school in the US or maybe were in school and tore their knee up and now they're a couple of years out, but they're getting back and they want to get back into school, things like that. So it was, being resourceful, being persistent and not aiming too high with your base recruiting, but taking a few swings every now and then. And maybe if you hit one of them, that makes all the difference in your program.
Yeah. When you got some high character guys in there, and maybe you can afford to bring in one guy that maybe you can take under everybody else's wing. But when you start getting more than that, as you found out, obviously that didn't work quite the way you anticipated.
For sure.
So you eventually take your own sabbatical, and that leads you to an opportunity with the Boston Celtics organization, with the Maine Red Claws, which then leads you kind of down a path, which I don't know if you saw that path coming or if that was a path that you were trying to head down, or just how that all came together. So tell me a little bit about the sabbatical and how you end up with the Red Claws.
Yeah. So, if I hadn't worked for Coach Savoy and she hadn't taken her sabbatical, I probably wouldn't have thought of it. But my last contract at Lakehead that I ended up having, I had kind of maxed out salary wise. Like I said earlier, it was not the highest paying gig compared to the top NCAA schools for sure. So I negotiated a sabbatical for professional development reasons. I graduated 7 guys. We lost in the national championship game. I said, this is a good time to take it. So I had tried to contact all 30 NBA teams and ask them if I could volunteer on their coaching staff. I don't believe one responded. If one did respond, it was like a quick no or like a form letter. So I was kind of discouraged by that. I was pretty naive and to think that I could do that. And what I know now, obviously, I probably wouldn't have taken that approach. But at the time, I was shooting for that. I remember telling one of my fellow Team Canada coaches, I was doing U19s at the time, this, and he said, why don't you try the G League? And I happened to have 2, at the time, current G League coaches on Facebook. And I don't have Facebook anymore, but when I did, it was obviously some people on there you probably never laid eyes on personally, but for whatever reason, had their contact. So I reached out to both. One was coaching in California. I went out there. He invited me out. I told him what I was trying to do, just volunteer. He said, okay, you can, you know, basically drive the bus and do the laundry and basically be an intern, but nothing on the court. And I said, okay, well, my goal was to learn the pro game or as much as I could about it in that year. I wasn't worried about what I was going to be doing really too much or what was coming after that. I was going to recruit all season and go back to Lakehead after the sabbatical. The other contact was Maine, which is about a 6-hour drive from where I grew up. So I went out there. Mike Taylor was the coach. He's now has since coached pro overseas and been the Polish national team coach. He had a pretty good resume.
Yeah, we had Mike on. Great guy.
Oh, nice. Yeah, Mike's one of the best dudes out there. He's coaching in Canada right now. I still keep in touch with him. So Mike said the exact same thing as the other coach, except he added at the end, I could work guys out after practice. So that and being closer to home, I said, I'll take it. So I got my own apartment and spent the year doing laundry, carrying bags around, driving the bus to and fro the hotel and airport for the guys. I didn't travel. When the team went on the road, I would sometimes get to go watch Celtics practice or maybe play a game. And there was another intern at the time who had just finished playing, so named Jim Moran. Jim most recently was an assistant with the Pistons before that Trailblazer. So Jim and I were 35-year-old interns. They called us the guys from the Muppets that are in the balcony, the old guys. That was kind of what we were doing there. And learned a lot from Mike, learned a lot from the players and Jim and everybody else who was working there. And then I left a little bit early because the recruiting was starting to heat up and I had to get home to, you know, do some visits and things like that. So I left, found out a couple months later that Mike had moved on and they were looking for a coach, and the GM of the team and I had kind of developed a bit of a relationship, at least one of mutual respect. And he was able to help me get an interview for the job. And just like at Lakehead, 2 other people turned the job down and they went to me third. So I jumped at it and kind of figured I could always get back into Canada because we had some success the last few seasons. And this opportunity wasn't going to happen again. So I jumped at it.
How much contact in that first year and then kind of through that interview process, how much of a connection is there with Celtics front office and coaching staff at that point? Are they involved in any of that process or is that something that comes later?
So the GM of the Red Claws was the director of scouting for the Celtics at the time. He was really the only contact I had, and I only had contact with him because I would work out Chris Babb, a player by the name of Chris Babb, after practice. Chris had a good career overseas. He ended up getting a 10-day, I believe, that year with the Celtics, but Dave Lewin, who was the GM at the time, would tell me, okay, Chris needs to, you know, do X, Y, and Z to have a chance at a call-up. And here's players in the NBA that do X, Y, and Z well. Show him film of these guys. So I did that, and I learned a lot from Dave over the next few years. But that was kind of the first thing. I guess I earned his trust a little bit. And I know when the time came to hire a new coach, they wanted someone with head coaching experience. Normally in the U.S., they don't really value our Canadian college stuff, but I think because I had been there for a year, they saw that I was responsible, could handle, run a workout, do paperwork, things like that. So I had at least an opportunity to speak to the Angels, Danny and Austin. I became friends with Ron Norred, Ron played for Butler under Brad, and then Brad brought him to our staff there. He spent that year as an assistant at Maine. We became close mainly because I was asking Ron how they did things at Butler, trying to learn to go back to Lakehead. But he also would put a word in for me when that time came with Brad. So I had a little small foot in the door, and then once you know it started to open up a little bit, I remember going down to Summer League in Orlando just to hang around in case they might want to talk to me. And sure enough, on like the second last day, I remember Ron texted me and said, get down here quick. Brad will have lunch with you and I if you can get here. So I sprinted down in the middle of July in Orlando, sweat just dripping off me as I sat down. The waitress came over and asked if I was okay. And I was also nervous, obviously, and Ron could sense this. And he just – remember him telling Brad, he's Canadian, coach. He's not used to this weather down here. So
help you out more ways than one.
Yeah, kind of just broke the ice. Within 24 hours, I met with Brad, Danny, and Austin. And a couple weeks later, Brad called to offer me the job and was one of the best calls I've ever gotten.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, talk about sort of a change in career paths, right? You're going down one direction where you think you're kind of going to be set there coaching to Canada. And now, boom, all of a sudden you get this sabbatical, you get an opportunity. It speaks to, right, being in the right place at the right time, but also making contacts and doing the work that you have to do while you're in place, no matter where you are. I think that's one of the lessons that, Scott, that we've learned more than anything across the podcast is people that have a similar story to yours and that, you know, hey, I got this job and maybe it was low paying or maybe it was no pay at all. And you go in there and you do the best work that you can and you catch somebody's eye. And before you know it, a door opens up that you kind of had no idea that it was going to open. And I know we've talked to several other G League guys over the course of the time that we've been doing the pod. And I know they always talk a little bit about some of the challenges of coaching a G League team where you have, you know, the players who are there, obviously they're thankful to be there, but clearly they have a goal in mind of trying to get to the league. And a lot of times executives and coaches who are coaching in the league also have dreams and aspirations of moving up. And yet you still have to build a team culture and put a product out there that you're trying to win games and help guys develop. So there's a lot of different things that are going on when you're coaching at that level. So talk a little bit about just your experience with it and what you enjoyed about it, maybe what some of the challenges were.
So I guess I've had, and I totally agree with you. I always tell, sometimes people ask me for advice, young coaches or whatever. And I always say, you got to be willing to do something that you might think is beneath you in order to get to where you want to get to. Not that anything is beneath any of us, but you know, experience and resume sometimes, hey, this, I can do better than this, but you have to do something to take a jump, like take a tunnel instead of a bridge sometimes. So I've had two runs in the G League. The first one was with Maine. I did three more years as the head coach with the organization before getting called up. And then my second time was just this past season with Salt Lake for the one season. And I think the league has changed a lot. It's a lot easier to coach in now, and the logistics are a lot better. The conditions are a lot better. But the overall situation is the exact same, and that's that every single person in the G League is there with bigger goals in mind. And the biggest key, and what I find probably the most challenging or enjoyable or both, is figuring out how to get through to each person as to what they have to do to get to their goals. Because 99% of the time, it's not what they think it is. And the obvious example is players. There's no NBA team looking in the G League for the next, I would say Kobe Bryant, right? Right. They're looking for the next Robert Covington or someone like that. And, finding ways to, I guess, convince the guys that playing as a team, playing a role, playing the right way, being professional, all those things that may not be on ESPN, are actually the key to getting where you want. It's not trying to score 30 every night, because no one thinks that's going to transfer to a 30-point-per-game score in the NBA. So that's what I find the most enjoyable, is trying to reach the guys from that perspective. And then the challenge is to get them to play as a team. If everyone plays as a team, everyone eats, so to speak. And when that happens, then you have real success in the G League.
How much of that conversation takes place with a player on the floor in a team setting, on the floor in an individual player development session, versus talking to them off the floor about, hey, here's where we see you, here's what an NBA team may be looking for, let's double down on your strengths? Just how do you go about making sure that player is hearing the message? Because I think it's one of the things that this is another conversation that we've had a lot with guys. And I think Mike Procopio was the first guy that kind of brought it to my attention, talking about how, you know, there's only, again, how many guys in the league, 12 guys, 15 guys, maybe, that just kind of have carte blanche to, hey, here's the ball and you're going to kind of do what you want to do. I mean, not every team in the league even has one of those guys. And so somebody coming out of the G League clearly isn't going to be, hey, man, we're just handing you the ball and, you know, go do your thing and score 30. So you got to find your role and your niche. So how do you communicate that to guys so that they understand it and really are able to make sure that they're getting what they need so that they can have an opportunity maybe at the next level?
Well, I'd say the best thing I've learned is that each guy is going to react to something different. So each guy is going to have something different or different approach to get through to them. And you don't always know what that's going to be. Sometimes you can get to know them really well and figure it out. Other times you're taking guesses. So I've always tried to take as many swings as I can and hope that each swing maybe hits one guy or two guys. So for example, what I mean by that is maybe one day I'm putting on the board a list of the last 10 call-ups or last 10 days and sharing some of their stats. I remember one year that the 19 of the last 20 call-ups at that time weren't in the top 10 in the G League in scoring, for example. This year, one thing we did was we, each week for about a month, we took a different guy who had to grind it through the G League and then made it to the NBA. So example might be Kem Birch. What did Kem do well in the G League? Well, he blocked shots, he rolled, he set good screens, he crashed the glass, he sprinted in transition. We chose some clips of those things. Then we put on the slide how much money he's made since he got called up, which is usually, it's always different, but it's obviously a lot more than what the guys in the G League are making.
Absolutely.
Just trying to find different ways to get through to somebody, not maybe necessarily knowing which guy is going to react to what, but if you spend a few minutes each week or, you know, each film session, just reminding them who had success and why, hopefully you can get through to them in some form. So that's what I've tried to do this past season, especially. And if you get lucky, you have guys that are pretty smart and understand this already, and then you're just reminding them. And every now and then you might have to bring a guy in and say, like, hey, wake up. This is what you're here to do. You know, I had a guy one time who was a great corner three-point shooter and a great defender, and he was complaining about being standing in the corner and shooting and having to guard the best player. And I'm like, you're going to get called up the fastest.
Yep.
Because you have an actual role that the teams can see easily and you're doing it well. So just be patient. And sure enough, he did get called up at the end of that season. So, and that would be a lesson that I would tell the next guy. You know what I mean? So he's always, you're just compiling little stories and little examples that you can. Hopefully you'll get through to everybody by the time crunch time happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so interesting because, again, all these guys obviously have been the best player in their environment, wherever they've been, for a long, long time. And then to come in and be like, okay, you got to play this role and this is what you need to do. You need to double down on the skills that you have in order to be able to get to where you want to go. I mean, it's clearly the ability to communicate in that role as a head coach in the G League is critical to be able to make sure that those guys understand what you're trying to do. And then, again, like we talked about, to be able to take that and build a team culture where, hey, you know, it's, we got to share the ball. We're all going to benefit if we play the game the right way, because then teams in the league are going to see, hey, we're playing the right way and this guy fits in. And we can kind of see, like you said, what skills that player has translates to what an NBA team might need at the back end of their bench, which is where all those guys are clearly trying to get to. Another example here of you just doing a really good job in the position where you're in, and then you get an opportunity to move up to the Celtics. Tell me a little bit about how that happened and what those conversations were like and what led to you getting an opportunity on the Celtics.
So I guess luck is one way to describe my journey, I guess. And then the other one might be I've tried to find some way to make myself, I guess, useful. And sometimes you got to take a few shots at that before you hit on one, just like with trying to get through to the guys. We had three really good years in Maine. The goal of the G League is obviously not to win, but when game day comes, you want to try and win. And part of the development is teaching guys what turns into winning, I suppose. So it is a good reflection on how you do. But I couldn't get called up. Network is a big one, I think. I saw some guys getting called up that, you know, we had beaten up pretty good over the years. And, you know, just because you won a few games in the G League, if the organization doesn't trust you, they're not going to hire you. And they can't trust you if they don't know you. So that was a disadvantage for myself. The Celtics guys, I did my best to get to know them. And then I started to track shot selection. I kind of came into the G League when the whole mid-range versus threes debate was just starting to rage. The year I was volunteering as an intern, I did a study of about 15, 20,000 threes and how they were created. It wasn't that crazy of a study, but it was, I think it showed a little bit of initiative. And I basically came to the conclusion that kick out threes were better than pull up threes. I didn't need to watch 20,000 shots to figure that out. But sometimes when you have numbers beside something and, you know, you can make something look a little bit more intelligent than it actually is. But that was my first step, I think, to kind of catching their eye a little bit. And then as I went through the three G League seasons, I would always spend some time tracking the Celtics' three-point shots during the season. If I saw something, I would report it to Coach Stevens, and I would send him a report at the end of the year. So fast forward a few years when I was on staff, that backfired because I became the shot selection guy, which every player's favorite coach is the shot selection guy. So, but I wore it proudly and did my best, and I always saw it as a way that I showed kind of, hey, I'm looking for ways outside the box to help the team improve. I'm not just going to go through the motions. I tried to always make sure I watched film and kind of took the assignment of the two-way guy. It wasn't two-way guys then, but assignment guys. Anybody the Celtics had drafted and stashed, like we had Abdul Nader 1 year. So those were my guys, like just like an assistant coach would have a player assigned to them. I took the top guys and watched film with them every game, every practice, worked them out, pregame, just like the assistant coaches would do. Because in my mind, I was an assistant coach for them in terms of the Celtics while I was coaching the Red Claws as the head coach. So I think all those things maybe added up a little bit to help me, but it still took 3 years. And just like that first call when Brad called me to offer me the G League job, my second favorite memory is probably being in his office when he let me know he was going to bring me up to the big team and make me a Celtic officially. So that was quite a 4 year, I guess, journey, but it was, I had an awesome time, and I really never set out to be an NBA coach when I moved to Maine the first time. But once you get a little taste and see what it's all about, it's hard not to have that as a goal, you know, in the back of your mind.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, three-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder Vlad Moldovanu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, Hoopheads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial.
I guess that begs the question, how much fun is it to be around the guys who are the best in the world at what they do?
So I recruited a kid at Lakehead named Zach White, who was not a good basketball player, and I hope he hears it. He's a very smart guy. He's a genius basically in school, but I recruited him from where I grew up, that area, because he was the one kid that had a chance to play. I brought him to Lakehead, and he was He was no Jason Tatum, put it that way. But whenever people ask me, like, what's it like coaching the best guys in the world, I would always say I'm teaching them the exact same things I would have taught Zach White at Lakehead. They're just driving away in a lot better car. So I tried to keep that in mind. I also had a good learning experience. My very first assignment on the Celtics staff was to go out to San Diego and work out Gordon Hayward. Gordon signed with the Celtics at the same time I was promoted, and Brad basically assigned him to me amongst a couple other guys as well. But that was my first big assignment. And I'd probably been to only 8 NBA games before I got the job in Maine, and still hadn't really gotten to know any NBA players other than the guys that were assigned to the team. So I was a little bit intimidated, and I was trying to figure out on the flight out there, like, how am I going to approach this first day? Like, you know, I don't want to come in too arrogant, and I don't want to come in like I don't know what I'm doing. So I came up with the line that I would tell Gordon, like, hey, you're coming off an all-star season. I'm just going to, you know, basically help you do what you've been doing and not get in your way, but I'm here if you need anything. That was what I decided I would say. And I did say that my first day with him, and he said, no, that's not going to work. You're here to make me better. And Brad wouldn't have assigned you here if you couldn't do that. So that's what I'm expecting you to do. And it was quite an eye-opener because I realized, one, I got to have more confidence. I wouldn't be there if I didn't deserve it. Obviously, people have gotten to that position a lot easier than I had. I had to have some confidence in myself. I had to also make sure I came every day with reasons for doing what I was going to do, because I knew Gordon would challenge and ask why we're doing certain things. But I also realized, probably most importantly, that the best players in the world, for the most part, want to be coached. And if you come correct with it, you can earn their respect, and that will go a long way to earning the team's respect when you have to address the team or run a drill or do a scout. So I was glad he responded that first day the way he did. And I don't think I've ever told him about that since, but it's stuck with me certainly over the last 6 to 8 years.
Yeah, it's something that I've heard other coaches talk about, the fact that, especially when you get to the highest level, that guys don't really care about where you came from. They don't care about your background. They're not looking at this or that. It comes down to exactly what Gordon Hayward told you, that, hey, if you can make me better, then that's what I'm interested in. If you can make me better, then you have value. And if you can't, then I'm probably going to look to somebody else on the coaching staff to be able to fill that role. And I think anybody, I don't care what job you have, like hearing you talk about just having a little bit, being unsure, right, as you go into that. And yeah, hey, I'm working here in the NBA, and I know that I've been in positions where I walk into a gym and I'm like, ooh, you know, I'm working with whatever, it's high school players, or I'm working with eighth grade girls. I'm like, all right, am I prepared enough to be able to do the things I need to do to show them what it is that they need to do, whether it's a practice session or a training or whatever it might be. And now you're talking about doing it with NBA players. And I think ultimately it really does come down to, hey, can you make them better? And the way you do that, right, is through the prep work and all the time that you put in learning your craft and getting connected with people who you've been able to learn from. And I think as you do that, it's just a matter of, once you get in there and you step in and you do it a few times, now you start to build that confidence that, hey, I belong here, and the knowledge and the time that I'm putting in, right? If you don't put the time in, you're never going to be successful at anything. I don't care if it's coaching junior high basketball or it's coaching the NBA. You got to be willing to put in the time and learn your craft and stay on top of things, which obviously from the different stories that you've told over the course of time here, that's what you were doing, and that's what enabled you to step in and feel like you were going to be able to have success.
Yeah, no question. I'd much rather work with a player that's going to challenge me and question me, because then when I come into the workout, I probably have some video, I probably have some numbers, I probably have video of someone else doing what I want them to do. And that's the best way to show them that you care, most importantly, that, you know, you care about them getting better. That's, like you said, that's what they want more than anything.
How did Brad Stevens divide up roles on the staff? What's that look like in terms of figuring out who's going with which player and who's going to be doing what during practice? And how does that conversation take place? And what was Brad's philosophy in terms of dividing up responsibilities on staff?
So I think every place is different. I thought Brad did a good job of using the whole staff. We had a pretty deep staff, in my opinion, at the time, for those 4 years that I was there. Guys like Jerome Allen, who was a college head coach, an NBA player, a great NBA assistant coach to this point. Jay Larinaga, who has been one of the top assistants in the league during his time. Micah Shrewsbury, who just took a little more paycheck than I was getting at Lakehead for Notre Dame. So the list goes on and on. We added Joe Mazzulla, who also was one of my assistants in Maine for a year. Obviously, Joe's risen up the ranks really quick. So we had a really balanced staff. It wasn't so much about where you were sitting on the bench, front or back or whatever. It was more about what your role was and doing it to the best of your ability. So Brad would kind of – he would assign a couple guys to each coach for individual work, and you were responsible for their video, working them out in the off season, pregame, pre-practice, things like that. And then you were kind of assigned a side of the ball. He didn't have a coordinator, so to speak, but based on your scouting assignments, that's what side of the ball you're on. So, for example, Jerome and I were on the offensive side of the ball, scouting opponents' defenses and reviewing our offensive video. So we would send in our reports post-game on video, and we divided the scouts up in half and presented on our particular game day. So that's how we did it. Brad was very careful to – like some teams, the staff is like, okay, we're hiring so-and-so as the defensive coordinator. And we all input on both sides of the ball. And Brad was careful not to really identify that in the media because, sure, it's great if things are going well. If we're the best offense in the league, it would be great for people to know what side of the ball I'm on. But what happens when we score 80 points?
Right.
And now we're getting the blame, which is probably he was trying to protect us from that as well. So we had kind of unwritten duties, but everyone contributed equally and everyone had equal say no matter where they were sitting, which I really liked. I was in the back row for 2 years and the front bench for 2 years. And in both cases, I thought it was great that we had everyone kind of adding value.
How's the role shift from the back bench to the front bench? What's that entail in terms of how you're going about your day to day?
Well, on that team, it didn't matter. It was the same. But every team does it different. I know just from watching Utah. So obviously I coached the Utah G League team last year and will be with the big team this year. But from what I've seen, it's a little bit different. A lot of the back row guys in Utah are focused on player development. They have more players assigned to them. They aren't necessarily in all the meetings per se. If there's a impromptu meeting, maybe it's just the top three or four or five coaches. And they'll leave the meeting when it's their player's time to shoot, for example. So I'm not sure how Coach Hardy's going to do it next year. I am expecting to have maybe one player assigned to me and then, pull my weight with whatever other tasks that he sees sees worthy of me doing. So other teams have a player development staff and the top two or three guys don't do anything with players one-on-one, but they're doing all the scouts and the player development guys don't do scouts. So it just depends on the team, depends on the year. In Boston, we just did a little bit of everything. Everyone did a little piece of everything. And I think that was good for our development as coaches as well.
When Brad steps down, you get an opportunity to interview for the Celtics head job. What does that look like? What's it like going in the interview for an NBA head coaching job?
To be honest with you, that's one of my biggest regrets so far was that month period. And I would argue Brad stepped up as opposed to down. I'm not sure what he gets every 2 weeks, but I'm guessing he's doing okay. And he's proven that he's been great at it. So he's just a really smart dude that can do a lot of things. And I think his demeanor has a lot to do with it. So when he told us that he was stepping up, I'll call it, I was a bit naive. It was the second time in my career I've been a victim of being naive. I figured I could just get another job. I was on the front bench with the Celtics. Teams will be lining up to hire me. I'm not going to panic too much. I did want to be a head coach at the time. I was kind of starting to become obsessed with that, and not in a good way. So Brad interviewed three or four of us from the staff, and I would consider all of us worthy, but I didn't really believe I was going to get the job for whatever reason. So I didn't go in taking it very seriously. He, I remember him telling me that, don't worry about, you know, presentations and things like that. Just come in, we're going to talk about basketball. Well, I've been talking about basketball with this guy for 4 to 6 years. So what I should have did was prepared a presentation, highlighted some of my strengths that I think I could bring to the position, maybe some things I would change. And I just didn't do that because it wasn't asked of me. I had an interview for the Wizards shortly after, and that was my first time putting together a presentation, and I don't think I did a very good job of it. Following that, I had an interview with the Perth Wildcats in Australia, and I think I crushed that presentation. So I feel like if I had maybe prepared for the Boston one a little bit more, and pretended that I had a chance, even if I maybe didn't, I would have been better prepared for the next one and so forth. So I do regret that time, but I was very grateful that Coach even gave me a chance to talk to him about it. But then as I would learn again, probably for the third time in my career, in the weeks that followed, that network was pretty important, and mine was limited, and it was going to start to cost me again.
What's a great presentation look like?
I don't know. I think it's more how it feels. Like, the look is obviously important, and I just finished being part of the interview process for our G League, the guy who's replacing me, which was Coach Wojo, and I got to see 15 presentations, so most of them were better than my best one was. But I think the organization of it, the aesthetics is important, but then it's like, how well do you know this thing? Like, you know, it goes the same old thing with your players. You don't want them to memorize. You want them to understand. And when you're interviewing someone that really understands what their strengths and their philosophy are, then they come across that much more confident, and you tend to believe that they know what they're doing. If the presentation is sloppy, you're going to kind of get a bad impression to begin with. But if you can have a tight presentation and present it in a way that's not going to, you know, drag on or leave holes, then to me that gets you that second interview, which then you start to be able to show what you know from an X's and O's point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, right, you have to break through the wall first and get, you know, make an impression. And then from there, you can dive more into the nitty gritty details and really demonstrate kind of what your vision is for that team and that job. And it sounds like you were able to do that with Perth, and you go over to Australia. What's that like when you take that job? And what was that year like for you in terms of both just the experience and then kind of what you learned coaching as a head coach at that level?
Well, I could do a whole chapter of podcast on that on that year. Well, first thing I learned was I need a better network. I remember my wife sitting me down before we took the job and saying, all right, if you take this job, you're going to make a list of everyone that you know in the NBA and check off when you text them, email them, call them, whatever, every month. That did last for maybe 2 months. I still have to work on it. So that was the first thing I learned. The next thing I learned was, I guess, be careful what you wish for. I was really excited to take the job. I don't regret taking the job, but it was, in a lot of respects, a year close to hell for my family. So it was middle of COVID. Australia was kind of opening later. So I took the job around Labor Day, and training camp was just starting then. I coached over Zoom for 6 to 8 weeks. So basically with the time change, I would wake up with the film from the previous practice. I would cut it, plan the next practice, have the whole day, and then meet with my staff when they woke up, which was in the evening in my time in Canada, because we're waiting to get over to Australia. We're not allowed in the country yet. They would have a coaches meeting, and then we would do a team Zoom where I would break down film from the previous day. Then they would go and practice, and then we would repeat that 5 days a week for 6 weeks. Finally, we get the word that we can go to Australia. So in the meantime, my wife had our second kid the week I took the job. So we were basically waiting to get her passport. We're Canadian. We were living in the U.S. She needed a passport before we could travel. That's a whole other story. Long story short, we get it. So we can go over to Australia end of October. Our preseason games are starting in 2 weeks. Like a lot of overseas teams, there's a long preseason, but I missed it all, or I was doing it on Zoom. We land in Perth. It was a massive plane going from Singapore to Perth. There was six people on the plane. It was just really eerie. we get there. They're really paranoid about COVID. Police escort to right to a hotel, and we're in a hotel room for 2 weeks. Still coaching on Zoom, all that stuff. We're not allowed to open a window in our hotel room because they think we might cough and the COVID germs would fall down into the street. It's just outrageous. So we finally get out of there and we go to what's called the Blitz. It's the preseason tournament. It's a 2 week tournament. I leave, my wife and two kids are there. We had arranged a nanny. So she has a little bit of help, but she's on her own for 2 weeks. The first 2 weeks that we're out, we come home. All right. Things are getting back to normal. Okay. It's December. Our first four games are at home. We find out during that time that the country is going to open January 1st. Great. But our state, where Perth was, is not going to open. So teams aren't allowed to travel in and out of Perth during that time. So we play our four games. The league makes us go to Tasmania and set up our camp there. Families can't go. So I dragged my family over there for this opportunity. Meanwhile, I still have a year left on my contract. I just wanted to keep coaching. I have a year left on my Celtics contract. So I left them in Perth by themselves with my wife had a 2-year-old and a newborn. And we go to Tasmania for 6 weeks, play half of our road schedule. Then we can't stay at that place anymore. We go to Melbourne for 6 more weeks and finish out our road schedule. Finally, the state opens and we're going home. Now, we're going home with the best road record in the club's history, which is great. The club also has a very proud record, asterisks, but a record of 30-something straight playoff appearances in this league, right? So we're in great shape, but it's just taking a toll. Like, it's just taking a toll on us. We had one point in time where we had 12 guys with COVID at once. We get home. Our best or second best import destroys his ankle. He's done. And we lose our last three games all in the final possession of the game, either them making or us missing, and miss the playoffs by a half game. So I think we finished 16-12. And it was a complete failure of a season because we missed the playoffs and ended this so-called streak. So in a way, it was one of my favorite years because it was of the challenges and all I had to learn. And I loved the players. When we actually got to stay in Perth, it was an amazing city, probably the nicest I've ever been to in the world. But despite all that, it was still kind of viewed as a failure in my eyes too, because I wanted to keep the record going.
Right.
So I guess it was a bittersweet year, but I wouldn't take it back because of all I was forced to learn and deal with, not only as a person, getting humbled a little bit, but also as a coach, having to figure a lot of things out with, you know, different resources and different conditions that you wouldn't normally get. Sorry, that was a long explanation of that year.
No, absolutely. Did your wife know what she was getting into when she married you?
She didn't know she was getting into that. That's damn sure. She wanted me to go because she knew how much I wanted to keep coaching, even though we could have just sat there and took a check.
Right.
But I really wanted to try it, and I did want to check a box of coaching a high-level FIBA team. And we met people there that are going to be friends for life. We may not see them that much, but they're going to be friends for life. And it was the first time in our lives that we probably didn't take things for granted. We would wake up in the morning, you could see the ocean. You know, it was basically living in paradise, and we would say to ourselves, we're going to enjoy this because – we're never going to live somewhere this nice again. So
right.
We often say now, like, we're glad we did it. We're glad we're back, but we're also glad we didn't take it for granted. We you know, consciously appreciated what we had when we were there.
Absolutely. So you come back, you're a season as a head coach in the G League again for the Salt Lake City Stars with Utah. And now you have an opportunity to move back up to the Jazz, coach with Will Hardy, who clearly is one of the rising young stars, somebody who has already built a reputation in such a short time as being a guy that is going to be one of the outstanding coaches in the league for a long, long time. So tell me how you get that call up. You already mentioned that two of your best moments were moments where you were called up. So I'm assuming this one probably ranks up there as well. And just talk about your relationship with Coach Hardy and then kind of what your role is moving forward and kind of where you are at this point.
Sure. So we decided to leave Australia mainly for our kids' reasons. And we actually came back to North America with no job. I was doing exactly what I'm doing right now as we're speaking, which is coaching with the U23 team in Toronto, the Canadian U23 team, and had a random call from an unknown number, and it turned out it was Coach Hardy asking me if I was interested in going back to the G League, and I quickly said yes, because I had nothing, and I wanted to try and get back in with a different organization. And we had also my wife and I identified Salt Lake as maybe a good place for our kids for various reasons. So it was an awesome stroke of luck. Like, the rest of my jobs have been pretty well based on luck. I also learned something else that day, which was never to judge a person if you don't know them. And the reason I say that is because Will, he didn't know it at the time, but Will basically replaced me in Boston. I remember sitting in my house back in Canada, you know, refreshing Hoops hype and Twitter, not knowing if I was going to be kept on the staff, and saw that Coach Ime had hired Will Hardy out of San Antonio, and that's basically my spot. Like, he's offensive-minded role, not a former player, front bench. All right, I'm probably out. So I didn't really think too highly of Will, to be honest, at the time.
Yeah,
I didn't know him, and I've told him this since. We've joked about it, but for him to get that to call me and basically save my career, I'll be forever grateful to him for giving me a chance, because he didn't know me, and he just took the word of maybe, you know, Danny Ainge and Joe Mazzulla and Evan Brads, who he brought with him on our staff here to Utah from Boston. So all those people are pretty high in my books for either vouching for me or giving me a chance, or both. And from there, I said, I just ran with it. I was very humble and grateful to have the position, even though I had been in the NBA for a few years. I knew that lesson from my intern days, and tried to look for ways I could add value to Will's staff. One of the ways was just running a great program with Salt Lake, with the help of the front office and the other assistants and so forth, which I thought we did a pretty good job of. And the other was looking for ways to maybe suggest or help the Jazz staff. So I tried to identify one or two things I could help with, or, you know, maybe put a few clips together. Hey, have you thought about doing it this way? And I think he appreciated that. And just like you said, I remember the moment exactly. I was going to a Jazz game. I used to go to the games just to watch in the video room and just be around the staff as much as I could, hear what they were doing, maybe pick up on something that we could do in Salt Lake. And Will called me into his office and called Jay-Z and Justin Zanuck, the GM, in and said, hey, I'm not sure what role it's going to be. And this is early January, so but we're going to have you on the big staff next year. And it was probably the closest I've come to tears at work in a long time, just because of everything that my wife and I had been through the previous year and a half, to get that word that I was going to be getting the call back up. And I promised myself I would remain grateful, which I have. I owe those guys a lot, but also, just like living in Perth, not taking anything for granted this time around. And whether it's one more year, hopefully 20 more years, I'm going to appreciate all the moments.
What's the role? What are you doing day to day?
Coach is going to have me back on the front bench, and probably very similar to what I was doing in Boston, which is focusing on the offense. People think I can't coach defense, probably because my teams are usually last in defense. It's probably the reason why. I like to think I could, but whatever reason, I can't get it done. Offense will usually fare a little bit better. So, I'll just stick with what I do well. And, unlike Boston, I'm not going to be too worried about moving a seat over, because I've seen a little bit of that in Perth and some of the not fun things that come with it. I remember Jay Triano told me my first year in Boston that being an NBA assistant is the best job in basketball. And after going through the highs and lows of that, I have to say he's probably right. So whatever Coach Hardy asked me, I'm going to do the best of my ability and hope I can stay on the bus.
All right, let's wrap it up with one final two-part question. So part one, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then part two, which I think you've sort of answered along the way, but I'll kind of let you summarize it. what brings you the most joy about what you get to do day in and day out? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
So I think the most important challenge, I'm not sure it's going to be the biggest, but the most important will be to try and build some trust and better relationships with the players that we have on the roster this season. Obviously, being my first year, a lot of the guys will be familiar with me from being around training camp and after the G League ended, or maybe going to our games in the G League and just seeing me out there. They'll know who I am, but they'll not have any really knowledge of what I can do or can I help them or what I'm willing to do to try and help them. So that would be my biggest or most important challenge. What I love most about coaching, it's changed. It used to be winning versus losing, the highs of winning versus the lows of losing, going from the low to the high was what I was chasing most weeks, most weekends, or, you know, in college, but in the NBA, most days, I guess. Then it became getting a chance to work at the highest level. You know, putting that challenge and goal toward yourself to make it to the highest level, regardless of where I've come from or how I've come up. Because I take pride in the fact that I didn't have the easiest route. Like, I wasn't a former player or I wasn't somebody's nephew or whatever. So I take pride in that, but also realize that things can be short-lived, so keep grinding at it. And then it's changed from that to supporting my family and making sure that my kids have a good future and something to help them have a great life with. So I guess now it's all three of those things combined is where I find the joy or the satisfaction in coaching. And I don't think you can really lose sight of any of the three, because if you stop trying to win or stop trying to prove that you belong, or forget why you're doing it, I think the work will suffer and the drive will decrease. So you need both those things to keep going at the high level.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really well said, that there's always different things that can bring you joy, and each piece of it kind of is one part of the puzzle. And when you put all those together, that's when you know you've really found the right place. And again, I've heard you say throughout the podcast, just, you know, the amount of gratitude that you have to be where you were. And that's not to say that hard work and luck, which you've also mentioned along the way, haven't played a part in it, but just to be grateful for where you are and to be able to have those opportunities, that there's lots of guys in coaching that I'm sure you don't take for granted, that you've got an opportunity to do what you're doing day in and day out, is a special one. Before we get out, Scott, I want to give you a chance to share how people can reach out to you, get in touch with you. You want to share social media or share an email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And if not, you know, we'll just jump back in and wrap things up when you're done with that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if someone did want to hit me up, I guess probably Twitter would be the easiest one. I think it's @Scott_Morrison. I got a lot of followers when I went to Perth because I had the same name as the Prime Minister.
And it always helps, right?
Yeah, a lot of hate tweets as well, but a few extra followers. So
there you go.
I'm sure they've dropped off over the years, but that's probably the best way to get a hold of me if someone wanted to hit me up. And always happy to talk basketball for sure, especially the X's and O's, because you never know where you might learn something from them. And I'm talking about myself, not whoever hits me up.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.